Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we will invite your questions about children's health, something that we do every month on the program and have done now for quite a while. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the U of I. And on a Thursday here, once every month, he is here, and we talk about children's health. So the idea is that whatever's on your mind, it can have to do with development or behavior. We have talked about all manner of childhood illness. We've talked about vaccinations. We've talked about nutrition. We've talked about sleep problems, just about anything that you can imagine. As long as it would be the kind of thing you'd talk about with a pediatrician, well, you can call. And I know the doctor will do his best to help you out, give you some advice. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you are listening to us this morning. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Welcome back.
Glad good morning. It's good to be here.
One of the things that we talked a little bit about, or you know, you came in saying that recently there apparently within the pediatric community, there has been some talk about calcium. And now certainly people have heard lots and lots. We've talked about on this program, it's in the news a lot, about the problem, increasing problem that we have of osteoporosis. And that's particularly a problem for women after menopause, but also for older men, it can be a problem too. And the sort of the basic advice is, one of the basic pieces of advice is, make sure really throughout your life that you're getting the recommended amount of calcium. So let's back it all the way back to the beginning of life and talk about calcium and children.
You know, and this came out of the Academy of Pediatrics. There was an article published recently in the journal Pediatrics, the official journal of the American Academy. And I think what this article was basically saying is, boy, we don't understand a whole lot about, well, yeah, everybody's saying make sure your kid gets enough milk, that they get enough calcium. And the calcium varies depending on the age. Like, I think a newborn's supposed to get 400 milligrams a day. And it's recommended that the adolescent get 1,500 milligrams a day. And this guy was looking at this was a meta-analysis. So he was looking at all the studies of milk and calcium and that sort of stuff. And what he found out is that there are very few studies that he considered good that were well-controlled. And there's very little actually known about how much milk we really need to drink, how much calcium we really need to drink. And the calcium absorption is very complicated. If you eat a lot of protein, you're going to, or a lot of sodium, or a lot of potassium, you're going to lose calcium in your kidneys because there's a competitive reabsorption in the kidneys. So this whole thing is kind of a muddied mess, and we really don't know what we're doing. And I mean, calcium and bone growth depends on vitamin D, and certainly milk is a good source of vitamin D. Getting out in the sun is a good source of vitamin D, but you know, we're concerned about that because sun exposure leads to skin cancer, so we're getting less sun exposure, and we're probably more time on TV, so we're getting on the screen, computer and TV and whatnot, so we're getting less sun exposure. So milk's a good source of vitamin D, but vitamin D by itself doesn't do anything. Depends on normal kidneys and normal liver to activate it. So I think what we basically are saying is we don't understand this whole thing. It's very complicated. But we certainly need vitamin D. No doubt about that. We certainly need calcium because our bones are a lot of calcium. Mm-hmm. The other thing that came out of this in the commentary is how important activity is. It sort of goes back to the use it or lose it. If you don't stress your bones, the bone will weaken. The bone will respond very well to the demands of it. If the body's not going to waste calcium in a bone that's not used to support or not used to bear weight. So exercise is very important. So I guess what we're talking about is vitamin D is very important. Calcium intake is very important. Protein intake is very important because our bone is an active living tissue, so it needs protein in there too. And it needs activity. It needs to be shown. The bones need to be told, me, body, I need you. I need you to hold me up. So exercise is important, particularly weight-requiring exercises, weight training type of stuff. And the other thing this article implied, and again, I don't think we know for sure, the data is not in, but probably one of the most important times for activity and weight bearing and good exercise is in early adolescence. Probably around 14 for girls, a little bit later, about 15 or 16 for boys. And this just is because puberty starts a little earlier in girls than boys. So good exercise program, a good activity program, both cardiovascular and weight training type of program is important for all our lives, and particularly at that time. Because we think at this time, again, we don't really know what we think at this time. If you build good bones early on in adolescence, at the key time in adolescence, maybe, we don't know for sure, maybe you'll keep stronger bones through adulthood that way. And there'll be less chance of osteoporosis and osteopenia. Osteopenia is weak bones. Osteoporosis is the pathologic condition.
Right. Well, you know, when recently, a couple of the times that that Suzanne Troopin has been here, she's our OBGYN, and she's also on the program once a month, she's mentioned the fact that I guess there are some recent studies that show that sort of surprisingly that, and because there's been all this focus on making sure that you get enough calcium, she said there are actually some studies that show that particularly people who live in more northerly climes that maybe have less sun exposure may indeed not be getting enough vitamin D.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, just remind, as you said, that yes, the calcium is important, but the vitamin D is also important, and the weight-bearing exercise is important, all those three things together. Well, would you say, though, if you think that your kids are still getting close to the, around the recommended amounts of calcium and vitamin D and other things, and if you're offering them a good, balanced diet, that you would say probably that they would be okay? And how do you think about supplementation for kids? I know we've talked about this before.
If they have a good calcium intake in their diet, if they drink adequate amounts of milk, or if they don't like milk, calcium is available in certainly the green leafy vegetables, the spinach and the chards and that sort of stuff. Although that may not quite be as good because there's other chemicals in those vegetables that may interfere with the absorption of calcium. So milk or dairy products are probably our best source of calcium. And milk, all of our milk is supplemented with vitamin D, so that's probably our best source. And, you know, the other thing I got out of this study is, again, the Atkins diet, which I've never been a proponent of, a high-protein diet. Mm-hmm. If you waste more calcium in your urine, the higher the protein intake is. Maybe that's another factor that makes me dislike the Atkins diet even more than I did before.
Mm-hmm. We have talked before about vitamin supplements and kids. And you have said, and what seemed to have been sort of the prevailing attitude in the medical community is if a person is eating right, if you have a good balanced diet, that probably you don't need it. Although it seems like now recently I have this feeling that I'm hearing more physicians saying, well, you know, that is what we used to say. We used to say that, that what happens is if you take a vitamin supplement that you're going to have vitamin-rich urine because your body probably won't take it in and you'll just get rid of it. And now I think that there are some doctors who are saying, well, maybe that's not right. Maybe there might be some benefit to supplementation. What do you think?
You know, again, I think if you offer your family a balance, a good adequate diet, we need vitamins in very small amounts. They're going to be in the diet, and I really think vitamin supplementation is still not necessary unless you're pregnant or as you get to your after age 50 or so, as you get to the golden years.
Speaking as one who has crossed the line.
Yeah. Outside of that, I think, it's vitamins in or vitamins back out in the urine. Cause if you have a good diet, no. You don't have to have an ideal diet. You know, if you think you're eating a good, well-balanced diet and you're meat and vegetables and potatoes and fruits and that sort of stuff, I don't think vitamin supplementation is necessary.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he is here on this program once a month. It's always a Thursday. We talk about children's health. We've been doing that for a long time because we figured it'd be something people would always have questions about. So if you'd like to call in and you're thinking about your children or grandkids or nieces and nephews or whatever, the kids in your life, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll free 800-222-9455. Right now, there is a lot of attention going on in the popular media about performance-enhancing drugs in sports. And in fact, just today, there are supposed to be some ball players testifying on Capitol Hill about the use of drugs in sports. And the other day, we had someone here on the program who was a physician who was an expert in the area. We talked a little bit about it and also about the concern that there are now children, adolescents and kids who may be using these things. And we talked a lot about the anabolic steroids. I just am curious about another thing that is often abused, and that's human growth hormone. And actually, I was a little bit curious about what it is, what are the appropriate uses, and in what ways is human growth hormone actually, it is prescribed and is actually used. And when do you, I imagine there are probably some parents who look at their kids and think, well, are they growing appropriately? Are they at the appropriate height for their age? Are they going to get to be an adult, and are there going to be some problems because they're not at least of average size?
I think the only approved use of human growth hormone is in proven growth hormone deficiency, and I think it's not going to be used much for athletic performance because it has to be given intravenously. So I think that's going to, it can't be taken orally, so I think it's not going to be used. But, there has been some talk, is growth hormone. If we give our older citizens a little growth hormone, is that a little bit of the fountain of youth? And I think there's studies going on about that, but I haven't seen anything. Although I don't look at the adult, I'm not that familiar with the adult literature, but I don't think anything's come out of that. I think it's still, growth hormone is for those who are growth hormone deficient. And, your physician, that's why your physician does heights and weights on your child at every visit, hopefully, and plots those. And if they start falling off the growth chart, then you begin to wonder about thyroid disease and growth hormone deficiency. But as long as they're growing and continue, and their growth rate is normal, don't worry about growth hormone. Because kids who are growth hormone deficient just virtually stop growing. They just don't grow.
Okay, so it would be really obvious.
It would be obvious, Okay. And we're not talking about short kids in short families. That's probably genetic short stature. We're talking about, all the parents are at the 30th percentile, 50th percentile, whatever percentile, and this child is below the third percentile and just growing at a very, very slow rate.
Okay. We have a caller here, someone to talk with. Someone listening this morning in Urbana, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hey there. Mm-hmm. I have a four-month-old boy, and ever since he was born, he's had excessive fluid coming out of his eyes, so much so that in the morning he can't really open up his eyelids, and during the day I have to keep wiping the kind of yellowish matter that's coming out of them. And the pediatrician last month, he said that it was just his the tear ducts hadn't opened yet. But anyway, my mother-in-law has been saying to put boric acid in his eyes to help clear it up, and I was just wondering what you thought of this.
Not very much.
Okay.
Not very much. I think the standard is still, if it doesn't clear up by 6 months, then oftentimes an ophthalmologist will probe them. And, during fetal life, during formation and embryonic formation, the duct isn't, the duct forms up that drains the tears. The tears are, again, made by a gland at the upper outer part of the eye, and they drain across the eye, and they're supposed to drain into the little duct. Actually, it's two ducts that go into one duct at the medial part near the nose, and then they drain down in the nasal passage. And many babies, the duct for some reason hasn't quite opened. Usually the little bottom part by the nose hasn't quite opened, and it usually will open spontaneously. But before that, they tend to tear a lot, and they tend to get this yellowish matter. Usually the eyes aren't red, because if the eyes are red, then you think about conjunctivitis, about an infection. But usually these kids, the eyes aren't red. They just have a bunch of goop in the corner, and, mm-hmm. and sometimes in the morning they're stuck shut. Oftentimes we used to recommend massaging the duct, mm-hmm. Just rubbing it. And sometimes what that did is it just kind of, the pressure would kind of blow the bottom out and help open the duct. But if it's a real problem and persists, you eventually end up at the ophthalmologist. And what the ophthalmologists do is they put a little tiny catheter into the tear duct, and they usually just flush it out with a saline solution.
Okay. And the boric acid is a bad idea.
I don't think it'll do any harm to the child's eyes, but
okay.
To the best of my knowledge, it's not going to help either.
Okay.
And I don't think the baby'd like it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Right,
thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bojek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us once a month, almost on a Thursday. We talk about children's health, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We did have somebody who had a question off the air, and I hope that there's enough information that I can give you for answering the question. But the caller was interested in having you talk about she apparently has somewhere in her life here a child who is six who has lactose intolerance.
Okay. Lactose intolerance. lactose intolerance is probably something we all develop. Lactose is the predominant sugar of milk and dairy products, and lactose intolerance is present in a few babies. It's probably very rare in babies, which is a good thing because, again, it's the predominant sugar in human milk and cow's milk and all mammalian milks. And what happens with lactose intolerance is lactose is a disaccharide. It's two sugars hooked together. Our body doesn't absorb disaccharides of any kind. It has to split it. And with lactose intolerance, they're deficient in an enzyme called lactase. So it won't split lactose into monosaccharides, so it stays in the intestine as a disaccharide. It's not absorbed. The bacteria in the intestine say, hey, man, this is great. There's extra sugar in the intestine. So it ferments this sugar. And people with lactose intolerance tend to be gaseous. Sometimes they'll have diarrhea. Sometimes they'll have abdominal pains. And there's two ways to treat this. You can either give them the lactase, and this is available over the counter. There's a variety of products. Lactate is one, and there's some other products. So you can give them the enzyme they're deficient in with meals, or you can exclude lactose from their diet and limit the dairy products in their diet. Mm. But generally, it shouldn't be a long-term problem. It shouldn't be a severe problem.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Other folks who would like to call in this morning, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455.
You know, let's go on about sports a little bit more.
Sure.
We were talking about steroids, which are, I can't say anything good. They're performance enhancers. That's true. They're liver killers, and they do bad things to the psyche. They cause violence and other things. There was an article in the New York Times recently about just overtraining. Kids who dedicate their lives to sports, and they participate in sports in school. They get private lessons in this sport. So they're in soccer all year round, or they're in basketball all year round, and they're in it 5 days a week, or gymnastics, or whatever sport you want. And how these kids are having overuse injuries and needing surgery that's usually not done till late in adult years when the joints are just kind of have been beaten up for years and years. Well, these kids' joints are beaten up for years and years, except they're only 15 or 16 years old. And essentially their sports career is done. Their life is going to be less pleasant because they're going to have degenerative joint disease and they're going to have joint pains for a long time. So I think, again, are we raising our child to be an NBA All-Star or an NFL All-Star, or do we want our child to have a healthy, successful life and a balanced life? And do we need to be careful about, making sure this child's life is balanced and don't let them overwhelmed with the sport and just burn themselves up too soon.
I expect that there may be some cases where maybe, as you say, maybe parents are thinking about the possibility that their kids would have a career as a professional athlete, or maybe they're also thinking that, well, this is what's going to pay my kids' way through college. Maybe that they could get a scholarship. On top of that, I'm sure that there are kids who just love the sport so much, they would go at it 100% until they fell over, and that in that case, you know, maybe what parents need to say is, look, okay, you're really good at this. We know you really enjoy this, but you have to take a break sometime. It's not the only thing, and we don't want you to burn yourself out mentally or physically.
Yeah. And I think as a parent, you have the right and the obligation to say, okay, this is enough screen time, or this is enough basketball time, or this is it. Yeah. Get a life. Enjoy. There's lots of things out there to enjoy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, here in Champaign-Urbana on Focus 580 this morning, our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. We're about midway through the show. He's here with us once a month, always on a Thursday, to talk about children's health. He's a pediatrician and a clinical assistant professor at the U of I. So if you have questions, you want to call in, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
The ACIP, the American Committee on Immunization Practices, come out with the official recommendations on the new quadrivalent protein-conjugated meningitis vaccine. Okay. And the current recommendations are all 12 and 13-year-olds ought to get it. Because there's two peaks of meningococcal meningitis. One is in early childhood, preschoolers, and one is teenagers and college-age students. And then if 12, 13-year-olds miss it, and that's freshman year of high school, on entering college, especially if you're going to live in a dorm, you're on the should-get list. If you're traveling to an endemic area, you're on the should-get list, and there's other exceptions. I guess I was a little disappointed. I thought they'd recommend it a little more widely than they did, and it could be that, this year, the pharmaceutical companies are just getting in production. There's going to be some limitation of doses. Hopefully, it'll increase, and hopefully, they'll broaden the spectrum or the age groups that should get this vaccine, because it sounds like it's going to be a good vaccine.
Yeah. Well, is this going to be one of these things that now all kids going to college, you're going to have to demonstrate that that your kid got this?
Yeah, I don't think the college. Well, I wouldn't be surprised. It's so new that I don't think colleges have decided what to do with it. Colleges and universities have decided what to do with it yet. Although for a long time, a lot of colleges were recommending or requiring the old vaccine. And this one's even better. This one should be much better. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if most colleges and universities don't require this on entrance.
Mm. Okay. Well, again, we're here open to questions. The doctor and I can chat. We will. But I just want to make sure that people who are listening know, it's an open resource for you, too. So if you have particular questions about your children or the children in your life, you can certainly call in here and talk with him. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I came across there was a piece just recently, and I thought about you. It was in the New York Times last week, maybe about a week ago, about colic.
Okay.
And about the great mystery of colic, and what it is. And I expect that we probably heard over time, maybe with some parents who have that problem, and you have too, where you get the kid just seems to be unconsolably uncomfortable, and it seems to be nothing that you can do. There seems to be nothing obviously wrong. The child does not need to be changed. There's no pin sticking in them. They're not hungry. Everything you've done, everything you possibly can think of, and yet the child is just in obvious pain and discomfort. And it seems like that's one of those things that frustrated both doctors and parents, because no one really seemed to know what is going on. And it does seem to be one of those things that, it's a phase. It can be a problem for a while, and generally it just goes away. And almost no matter what it is you tell parents to do, nothing works.
Yeah. In Canada and Europe, they have grip oil or grip elixir or something, which is basically alcohol, I think, as I recall. So I guess you just get the child soused and they go to sleep and quit fussing. Yeah. When I was a medical student, the chief of pediatrics at Pres St. Luke's Hospital said, you know what, we don't know what causes colic. Nobody's ever died of colic, so there'll never be pathologic specimens, so we'll never find out what causes colic. And I think we're still at that point. What is colic? I don't know. I haven't the foggiest idea what causes it. Behaviorally, what it is a usually a predictable. You can about set your watch by when they start screaming and when they stop screaming. It's usually in the evening. It starts shortly after birth. By 3 months, it's almost invariably gone. And what do you do about it? Try anything. You know, the warm water bottles sometimes. People will swear by all kinds of things. But I'm certainly not a believer in letting them cry it out. Although, when the parents are getting short-fused, putting the baby in their crib and letting them cry and scream, and the parents walk down the hall or have a cup of tea or something like that and then go back and try again later when they've got their nerves settled in a few minutes is often worthwhile. Yeah. But, what colic is, nobody knows.
The thing about this I think was kind of interesting is that someone has proposed that what can work for soothing the babies is to do some things that will mimic conditions in the womb.
Yeah.
And that I think that's really interesting because it makes me think of all those stories people have said. They have fussy babies, and if they put them in the car and go out for a drive, it settles them down. And that there is some idea that it's a little bit – has to do with a little bit of the vibrations. It has a little bit of the fact that you just have this sort of steady kind of white sort of background noise.
A little bounciness,
a little – you know, sort of thing like that. And it seems to – and it sounds like what they're talking about in this particular piece is that there is some evidence to show that if you do things that will mimic that kind of experience, that actually does – help. And I know that there are people who have made these devices to attach onto the crib that's supposed to do that same thing, make it like, you know, feel like they were going for a drive. And that some people have said, they have tried that or some variant of that, and it has actually worked.
And have you ever noticed a parent holding a baby or even a grandparent or aunt or uncle or anybody else, the natural you start rocking right away. Mm-hmm. You know, you just you don't stand still and hold a baby. You just start moving a little bit. And I think that, I think colic, doesn't deserve to be ignored. But it's not a fatal disease. It's probably not a disease. And, do what you can to soothe the baby. Mm-hmm. Swaddling works. You know, I've heard of a variety of things that works. But that, don't ignore it. I think it's a baby's cry for help. And so do what you can to console them.
Well, now we have some people to talk to. Let's do that. Champagne is first, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the chicken pox vaccine. Mm-hmm. My kids both got the chicken pox vaccine. They're 6 and 8 now. And I've heard of a number of kids that have gotten chicken pox even though they've had the vaccine. So my question is, do I take them to visit friends who have the pox to try...
To have a chicken pox party.
Exactly.
No. You know, there have been a few cases of kids who've gotten the vaccine who've gotten chicken pox. It tends to be milder.
Okay.
At this point in time, I would do nothing. Okay. There's always been concern, and I think there's more talk about is a second dose going to be necessary. Mm. Because when the measles vaccine first came out, they fiddled around with the age, and then they finally decided we need two doses of this stuff because for most kids it works. The first dose seems to be lifelong, but there's a large enough group that breaks through and gets the disease in measles, and I would guess in the near future, in a year or two, it's going to be recommended that all people get. That the standard will be two doses of chickenpox vaccine.
Okay.
And I suppose you could go to a chickenpox, have the so-called chickenpox party. What's the chickenpox party? One kid in the neighborhood got chicken, before the vaccine, one kid in the neighborhood got chickenpox. Everybody went to visit this child so they could 2 weeks later you knew your kid was going to get chicken pox, you'd get over it.
Yeah.
So you could control when they got chicken pox, and that was the chicken pox party. And, yeah, I suppose you could do that, and that would be a booster dose of chicken pox vaccine.
Okay.
As a physician, again, I can not officially recommend exposing a child to a contagious disease, but yeah, it works.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Next caller is in southeastern Illinois on our line number two. Hello.
Yes, I really don't have a question, just a subject to throw out, and you probably discussed it before, but a couple of factors. You recently had on the program somebody saying that, the prejudice against the overweight, and it was just a cultural thing, and, I won't go into it, but you know what I'm talking about, the guest. On the news, I think I heard it this morning on the news, and I don't know when the survey was released by the university, but they were quoting a University of Illinois study that has stated that for the first time in many years, the expectation is that the life expectancy will drop by about 2 years, and the reason for that is obesity. So I didn't know whether you were familiar with that study or... I think you probably discussed obesity in children before, but I just thought I'd throw it out if you were interested.
Yeah, I guess I just caught that on the news last night, so I haven't read the study. But, I think, again, it's probably not a good idea to be morbidly obese. It may not, because we sure know that type 2 diabetes, or type 1-2 diabetes, as I call it, because it's a funny type 2 diabetes because it's usually insulin requiring, is seen in usually racial minorities, the people of color, the Hispanics, the African Americans, who are rather, they're not a little pleasingly plump, they're frankly overweight, develop this, and with weight loss it seems to come under better control. So I think it's... I think there's a difference between being obese and being a little plump. And I think being obese is not a good thing. Being a little plump is maybe not a bad, I don't know. And I think we talked about calcium and bone strength, and, there's a lot that's not known. And we do know that if you're obese, you have an increased incidence of heart disease and diabetes and other things. But what's the magic number? And is there truly and is my magic number the same as your magic number, the same as David's magic number? And how much is genetics factored in here and all that sort of stuff? And I think there's still just a lot we don't know. But to be obese, I will accept, is not a good idea.
Okay. I know that I did see, there was a story, in fact, just on the front page of the, I think it was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune this morning, mentioning this same study and making this case that, based on recent studies, that we could see this real effect on longevity. And it seemed that a real focus of the study was children.
Okay.
The fact that you would have kids who were overweight, and that would set a pattern for their entire life,
right.
And that would maybe indeed have an effect on their life expectancy.
And that may be, because we've well known that it's been well known for a long time that if one parent is obese, particularly the mother, that's rather significant on the child being overweight. If both parents are obese, the child really doesn't stand a chance of not being, almost doesn't stand a chance of not being obese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, they've talked about fat cells, and do we ever lose fat cells, or is that determined early on, and we can make our fat cells skinny, or we can fill them out, but we can't do anything about fat cell number. But I think there's still a lot that's, we just really don't know for sure yet.
Yeah. It was apparently led by someone who was at the U of I in Chicago.
Yeah.
Had the lead graph here, and people can go either to their website or the Tribune or look for the paper, but it says the growing epidemic of obesity could cause the first drop in Americans' life expectancy in modern times, according to a new study that suggests weight problems could cancel out life-extending benefits from medical advances in the coming decades. So That's kind of the
maybe the emphasis on could.
Well, yeah.
I mean, we're not sure. Yeah. It's probably not. Yeah, you know, we've got the Gaussian curve, the normal distribution. It's probably not good to be at either end. It's probably nice to be right in the middle.
That's kind of all this man I had on just recently. We were talking about it before the show. Some people who are listening might have heard it, who wrote this book called The Obesity Myth. And I know some people really called in and really took issue with the guy. Said one of the things that he said was if you look at the normal distribution curve of longevity and you look at people's weight, what he argues, and I'm only saying this is what he says, is that indeed people who are at the extremes, either extremely heavy or extremely thin, there indeed is an impact on longevity. But the people who are in the middle, he sort of said, you know, maybe if you're a little bit overweight, you're a little bit underweight, you know, maybe it doesn't make that much difference.
Yeah. And then there was, it was on the public radio news that they looked at the super long livers. And what they could find with them, the reason they live super long is because their parents live super long. It seemed to have nothing to do with their profession or their eating habits or whatever they did. Just their parents live super long.
Well, so I think also this guy, that's one of the points that he makes, is that we're not really quite sure what sort of role genetics plays.
Yeah.
And why it is that you know, some people tend to be bigger and some people tend to be smaller, and you can see that there's maybe a good chance that however they are, that's the way that their parents were, so that we really don't quite there are a lot of things that we really don't understand about how people put on weight. Well, let's go on. Let's talk with somebody else. Hoopston, line number, well, no, on second thought, I think we'll go to Champagne in line 3. Hello.
Hi, I have a son. He just turned 5, and he still needs to wear a diaper at night. He's
okay.
Not even close to making it through the night waking up dry. He's just soaked every morning. And his pediatrician has told me that with bedwetting at night, I guess it's more of a neurologic development, that until, you know, he makes that connection in his brain to wake up when he needs to go to the bathroom, that there's really not much I can do about it. And I don't know. At 5 years old, I was hoping that he'd be a little farther along. But his pediatrician has told me that it's normal up to even age 7 for them to still continue wetting at night.
I like your pediatrician. I agree with your pediatrician. I can't remember the statistics. I think something like 20% of 5-year-olds are still wetting the bed at night. And it's a male predominant problem.
Okay.
And yeah, what can you do about it? I'm with your pediatrician. I wouldn't do anything. If you really want to do something, you can get one of the bell buzzer alarms.
Yeah, he talked to us about that. I didn't know if there was something else that I might be able to try. I mean, I try to limit what he drinks, you know.
And that doesn't work.
Time and
yeah,
you know, it seems to help some. But
yeah, and make sure he voids before he goes to bed.
Sure, yeah.
But he still wets the bed.
Yeah.
And your pediatrician hasn't talked about medication?
No.
Good.
No, hasn't mentioned anything like that.
Good. Medication, there are several medications out there, and they do work some of the time. The problem with medication has side effects, medication has costs. And the major problem with medication probably is it, in the cases it works, and I can't remember the percentage, I think it only works about 50% of the time. The trouble is, the day you stop the medication is the night they start wetting the bed again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally why we don't recommend medication. So I think my best advice is probably what your pediatrician has said. Put them in a pull-up.
Okay. All right. And then another question. Is there any correlation with them, the longer it takes for them to go through the night without wetting, is that going to lead to problems later in life where he might be wetting the bed, you know, even like in his teenage years or something?
No.
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 Okay.
Almost all, yeah, I think after the age of, I hate to tell you about this, but yeah, some kids wet the bed up till 8, 9, or 10. But after the age of 9, I think we're down to like less than 1% of the boys are still wetting the bed.
Okay. All right, so we just have to wait it out and let him do it in his own time, I guess.
I'm with your pediatrician. I think that's the best recommendation with what we know now.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to line number 1 and someone listening in Danville. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I want to return to the colic issue.
Okay.
I became pregnant when I was 35 after many, many efforts. And my husband and I were so excited. It was as if we were the first people to ever have a child. And I was determined to do everything absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And so when my gynecologist handed me a list of things to eat, one of them was a quart of milk a day, and boy, I did. And I ate fruits, and I ate, just whatever. Well, turns out our daughter was born, and I brought her home, and it was as if she broke. And she cried, not just in the evening, as
okay.
you said, but just all the time. And I thought, oh, my gosh. So I thought, oh, well, obviously, and I was nursing. And so I thought, well, obviously something is wrong here, so I will just keep on this diet. And I kept drinking the milk, of course, and so on. And finally, after about 2 months, we went out to a friend's house, and they served wine. And I thought, you know, I'm tired of this. I'm just going to lean back, have a bottle of wine, and just not even worry about this kid. Because I, you know, for one night, the next day she was great.
Okay.
And it figured out, wait a minute, it's not supposed to work this way. And what I decided to do then was to drastically cut back my intake of milk, and she smoothed right out. And I nursed her clean until she was a year old. And never again did we have those difficulties. So I think that sometimes pediatricians need to look at food allergies. Because
yeah.
It was what I was eating that was affecting her.
Well, I think what needed to be looked at in your case is your child wasn't typical colic, was it? It wasn't that predictable time in the
no.
evening where
right.
you could set your watch. She was a fussy baby.
Yes.
And
yes.
And I think that's the red flag to say, uh-oh, I better not brush this off as colic. I need to spend a little bit more time with this mom and talk about this baby and see what's going on. Milk allergies as far as the milk protein intolerance and lactose intolerance is extremely, extremely rare in babies, but it has been found that milk protein crosses into breast milk.
Well,
that cow's milk protein,
will
be in the breast milk. And sometimes, look at the mom's diet and say, gee, I'm not sure what in your diet is causing this, but maybe something in your diet is causing this. So this may take a while, but we're going to eliminate things one at a time and see if we can find out something that's in your diet that upsets the baby. And,
right.
And probably milk and wheat and peanuts or something like that are sort of at the top of the list or the things you'll eliminate or cut back first.
So anyway, I'd like to just suggest that for your other listeners who may be having a difficulty. And the other thing is she continued to have this milk allergy until well into her teen years. So we just avoided it.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's 30-something or other and just fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we need to, it's the physician's job to make sure that these parents are complaining about colic, that they aren't complaining about something else.
Right.
That's masquerading as colic. Or don't be too quick to write off a fussy baby as, it's just colic. It'll go away.
Right.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less maybe, in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's on the program once a month. It's always a Thursday. We talk about children's health, and your questions are certainly welcome. We have a couple of other people here ready to go and want to make sure we get them in. The next caller is in Burlington, and that's line number 2. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about contagiousness with viruses. When there's a cold or flu going through a family, how long are the adults and children contagious once they become sick, where they might infect others or especially visitors?
Okay. I can't answer that specifically because it depends on the virus. And we know some viruses, like the one that causes fifth disease, the parvovirus, by the time the child has any symptoms, they're not contagious anymore. But that's a kind of a funny virus that way. Most of our colds and flu viruses, our winter type illness viruses, you're probably contagious the day before you have any symptoms. And then the tighter the number of viral units you shed rapidly decreases. So probably, if you want a number, probably you're contagious for 3 to 5 days.
Okay.
Yeah, you're certainly probably not contagious, or you're shedding in such low doses by the end when you're, your nose is still mucousy, you're still coughing and that sort of stuff, but probably toward that end, you're probably not contagious anymore. You're shedding in such low titers that you're virtually not contagious.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's go to Urbana for another caller. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. I was thinking about the bedwetting. Years ago, we had a 5.5-year-old who was wetting a bed, and we were going to be doing extensive traveling. And I just said to myself, you know what? We got to do something about this. And our family had a history of people who were very, very deep sleepers.
Mm-hmm.
My mother could wake up my brother to get him to go to the bathroom at night, and he wouldn't make it to. He would fall asleep on the way.
Yeah.
On the way back, he was so sound asleep. So I tried. I was able to order one of these bedwetting alarms, which is two pieces of foil. One, the top one has holes in it, and it's attached to a battery buzzer. I used that with my son. I think it just took maybe two times of it going off, two nights, and that alerted him. He now had been. It was a matter of training. He now could sense or paid attention in his sleep to the need to urinate, and we didn't have to use it beyond that, and it definitely made life a whole lot easier for all of us.
Yes.
Made it possible to travel, made it possible for him to sleep at somebody else's house when needed, and I think pediatricians need to think about those kinds of issues for a kid as well, because it can, depending on the kid's situation, become embarrassing.
Yeah.
Traveling causes a lot of stress when it doesn't need to.
This, the bell buzzer system the wet alarm system, or it goes by, a variety of companies make it. And they're much smaller now. It used to be a match you laid on, and now they're little pager size devices almost, with a little wire and a little snap that snaps on the front of the pajamas. So, the first drop of urine theoretically will close the circuit, a loud alarm goes off and rouses the child and lets him know to go to the bathroom. And some of these kids, and I've had the experience too, where some are such loud, and this is a loud alarm, where such are such sound sleepers that the alarm doesn't wake them up. So then, the parent or the roommate or whatever is the brother, sibling, roommate is the backup alarm to wake these kids up. And the thought is, these kids are conditioned to pay attention to their bladder. And this kind of goes back to when we're babies. Our bladder fills up and our bladder empties, and the brain is not particularly involved. It's just not an important thing at that time. And then as we go older, what's supposed to happen is the bladder is supposed to activate, tickle the centers in the spinal cord, and it's supposed to travel up to the brain. And the brain sends a message back to the bladder and says, hey, do you really have to go, or should I wake up the body and we'll go to the bathroom and empty? Or if you're not that full, just shut up and just tighten your sphincter and let the body sleep. And there's some thought that this communication between the brain, the spinal cord, and the bladder is late maturing in a lot of these kids, and that this bell buzzer system just sort of helps the pathways go. And I don't know if this is true or not, but it sounds good, and it is a large percentage of kids that wet the bed. The other unusual thing, and while we talk about deep sleep, maybe this is the solution. A lot of these kids, you send them to camp, they're dry. They're dry all week. They're dry all summer, but the first night they get back home, they've wet the bed again. And probably what happens is when they go to camp, or when they're at their aunt's house or grandma's house, they're not quite as comfortable as they are. They don't feel quite as comfortable as do as home, and maybe they just don't quite go into as deep a sleep. And so this cycle, this communication between the bladder, spinal cord, and brain takes place because, things aren't, sleep isn't quite as deep.
Well, as I recall, we had to get up and wake ourselves up too with the alarm, and get up and help the child, make sure the child was aroused and went to the bathroom. So it's a little wearing on the parents for a night or two, but for us it was definitely worth it. So
It's not guaranteed, but it's worth a try, and it's certainly much safer than medication.
Yeah, and it's not for use with an infant.
No.
No, we're talking about kids who are school age.
School age. We're talking about the 6 or 7 year old. Yeah.
Or five.
Yeah, somewhere at that age.
Depends on the kid.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say, now, last time I called in about Lyme disease and about the terrible problems that occurred to a relative's child who has had it for like 10 years without it being diagnosed and had psychiatric problems and missed school, all kinds of things. And I think that you said something about that in a lot of people it goes away and is taken care of, and that may be, but also I was just reading, I wanted to check on that, and checked with the National Institutes of Health website, and they were saying that, I don't know what percentage, but a lot of what causes difficulties with Lyme disease is that it has symptoms that can disappear for a long time, and then they pop up and they don't seem, because they mimic other things, they're really hard to diagnose.
Yeah.
So you can think that you haven't been affected by a tick bite or not pay attention to the rash that sometimes occurs because nothing happens right away, but it can happen years later. And the consequences can be really serious. So just wanted to follow up on that. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Well, I think at that we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We're going to have to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek.
I'll see you next month.
And he will be back again next month, and we'll do it all again. He's a pediatrician. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Thursday, he's here. We talk about women's health. No, we talk about children's health. That's another day of women's health. That's another thing that we do also once a month.